You're reserving 5 minutes of rebuttal,
yes,
I believe. Very well. You may proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. William J. Earl, Assistant Attorney General for the District of Columbia. This case presents a pre-enforcement challenge to the District of Columbia's excessive prescription drug pricing act of 2005.
Mr. Earl, before we start, why do we have jurisdiction over this particular appeal?
Because the plaintiffs below have claimed that this legislation is preempted by the Federal Patent Act.
Was it considered by anyone in regard to the transfer in a panel by the D.C. Circuit? It just seemed to come over here by an order of the clerk.
We made a motion for transfer, Your Honor.
Does that give us jurisdiction? Just because you made a motion?
No, it does not.
On what basis is that jurisdiction?
Once again, because the preemption challenge to through this act calls for an interpretation of the Federal Patent Act. Specifically, whether the objectives of the Federal Patent Act are at odds with the underlying goal of this local statute.
But it doesn't arise under the patent law.
No, it does not arise under the Patent Act, but it requires an interpretation of the Patent Act, specifically the objectives of the Patent Act, as they relate to a jurisdiction's attempt to restrain unconscionable prescription drug prices.
So on the with respect to that, then, you have a question as to whether or not we have a jurisdiction under the second prong of Christensen.
Your Honor, yes, and I think you do.
Well, that was not in your motion, though, that we could see. It was just a joint motion to have it transferred here.
Actually, it wasn't a joint motion, but
a motion.
A motion, yes.
The plaintiff's complaint did not raise a patent issue, did it?
It does not raise a patent issue per se. Once again, it raises the question of whether this legislation is at odds with the objectives of the patent system, of the Patent Act itself, which calls for an interpretation of the patent.
So it would be a substantial questioning of the patent laws?
Yes. There is a jurisdictional question that our appeal does raise, and we have argued that the district court erred in finding that the plaintiffs below established their Article III standing to prosecute their challenge, their pre-enforcement challenge to this act. The standard to be applied in that regard is the authority of the authority applied by the District of Columbia Circuit. Which, as articulated in the Seegers and Navigar cases, it is that the plaintiff established a special priority for enforcement or high probability that the challenged act will be enforced against them.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about that, Mr. Earl. That's a very interesting issue. Two questions. One of them is it clear that that this court is bound by the precedents of the District of Columbia Circuit with regard to whether the plaintiffs in this case have standing?
Yes, Your Honor, certainly to the extent that the precedents of the District of Columbia Circuit are valid in light of the authorities of the United States Supreme Court.
Ah, all right, that leads me to my second question, which is that at the time the standing issue was briefed, you did not have, I think, the benefit of Parker versus the District of Columbia, which is the latest expression of standing law by your circuit, the District of Columbia Circuit. Let me quote to you what they say. In both United Farm Workers and American Booksellers, the Supreme Court took a far more relaxed stance on pre-enforcement challenges than Navigar and Seegers, the two D.C. precedents, permit. Then the court goes on to say, nevertheless, unless and until this court en banc overrules these recent precedents, we must be faithful to Seegers, just as the majority in Seegers was faithful to Navigar. It doesn't seem to me that we need be faithful to either Seeger or Navigar. Rather, we need to be faithful to the United States Supreme Court's standing jurisprudence, don't you think?
Yes, Your Honor, I don't dispute that at all.
So we are, basically, the question I'm asking is, the question of standing is really for us to decide under our precedents rather than under the District of Columbia precedents.
Would
you agree to that?
Under the Supreme Court precedent, to the extent that the D.C. Circuit precedent, as that court has indicated, is in tension with the language articulated in both United Farm Workers and American Booksellers.
They use that term, intention with.
Very yes, good. Yes.
Yes. Okay, that helps me understand where we're coming from.
But, Your Honor, if I could use certainly as an analogy the standard that this court has articulated in its Jim Crow decision and applied thereafter, I think it is clear that the district court erred in not finding that standing had been satisfactorily established. What we have here is no evidence that has been presented that the generic provisions of this act would apply to a given member of these organizations.
That's the Navigar standard.
Your Honor, the Navigar standard, the Gen Pro standard, even with regards to the rationale of United Farm Workers case, you still have to show that the statute that's being challenged would be applied to the individual that's undertaking the challenge per the provisions of that statute.
Would be or threatened to be?
Well, Your Honor, I think the threat is part of the standard, but I think you also have to show that there is a basis for applying the statute to that individual. Once again, if I could use the idiom of this court standard, where you have a requirement of reasonable apprehension on the one hand, and then a showing of conduct, or at least intended conduct, that would qualify as infringing conduct. Here, at best, what we have is the plaintiff's apprehension that this act would be applied against them, but they have not shown that they are presently undertaking conduct to which this act would be applied or have the intent of doing so. The evidence that they have shown, and I guess the most compelling aspect of that evidence is the legislative history that was presented, argued in their brief in response to our brief, wherein the District of Columbia Council articulated the expectation that the act would be applied to two specific manufacturers, Pfizer and Merck. I submit that what that presents at best is a reason, expectation that the act could be applied to those manufacturers, but it does not, standing alone, establish that under the generic provisions of the Act, specifically the prima facie case provision that would identify a manufacturer to whom the Act would be applied, could apply to any of the members of these organizations.
It is a little hard, just stepping back from the legal nuances of state law, which are, as you well know, very difficult to make one's way through. Just as a practical matter, it seems that surely if the District of Columbia Council thought it was doing anything, it thought, and it was going to have a real world effect, it obviously did think that, that unless it's seriously mistaken, then these people are going to be affected by this statute.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
And it's a little, it seems a little artificial to say, well, we have to wait until we go through one of these elaborate procedures in order to demonstrate to ourselves that with a sufficient degree of confidence to be able to say there really is a controversy here that we need to address.
I don't think that what we're arguing for are elaborate procedures at all. Mm-hmm. All that we are maintaining is that these plaintiffs should come forward with some indication mm-hmm. that yes, indeed, we either are undertaking present conduct that would be applicable under the statute, or we have the intent, but for the prospect of enforcement of this statute, to undertake such conduct.
But because the statute has the flexible standards, I suppose it's a little hard to say with certainty. I mean, if the statute said if you charge more than $9 a pill for this certain drug, yes, then you're within the scope of the statute. Don't worry about the time. We'll extend your time in the same thing for Mr. Ogden. But that would make it pretty easy to say, well, now we know who's likely to be affected and who isn't.
Yes.
But given what I understand to be a fairly complex process of assessment of whether someone is covered or not in a particular instance, that sort of certainty seems a little hard to achieve, even though, practically speaking, we all know that there will be instances in which members of this these organizations will be affected, don't you think?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that the information that we contend is essential but lacking in this record is complex. The prima facie case provision of the statute is pretty straightforward. There's certainly, I mean, this is a pre-enforcement challenge, so there are a lot of uncertainties as to how the statute will be applied, and the statute does not give a fulsome definition of some of the critical terms, but it does indicate that manufacturers whose wholesale prices in the high income countries that the prices that result in the District of Columbia are 30% higher than those wholesale prices in those high income countries, they are liable under a prima facie case to have to come forward and justify their prices. That part of it is not complicated.
Could I ask, given the limited time,
yes,
let me shift your focus just for a minute to clarify something I'm a little confused about.
All right.
28.4.45.53 states that it's unlawful to sell a patented prescription drug for an excessive price. I'm obviously summarizing. And 45.54 creates this prima facie case.
Yes.
There seems to be a little confusion as to whether there's some sort of safe haven built into this thing. I don't see one. That is to say, under 45.54, I understand that creates a presumption.
Yes.
But putting that aside, do I read it correctly that 4553 states an absolute rule which could be violated without regard to whether the presumption of 4554 applies or not. Isn't that, am I correct about that?
Your Honor, I see Your Honor's concern.
One of the amici suggests that the statute has a safe harbor, but I don't find that in the statute, and I want for the record, I want us to be clear on,
yes,
on that question.
I think the safe harbor that's being referenced is the 4554B, where the manufacturer is allowed to justify and overcome the presumption that...
I read that as just their defense. Maybe I misunderstood the safe harbor. But for the forgetting the amici's problem, it is true, is it not, that you don't need the presumption in order to invoke the mandate of 4553, no excessive price.
That is true. That is true.
So you could have an excessive price that was less than 30% of these foreign country prices.
I would say that you conceivably could establish prima facie,
yes,
case.
You could win a case, not just prima facie case. You could win, presumably, under that statute if you convinced the trier of fact that there was an excessive price.
Right, and in that regard, Aaron, I think the factors that are articulated in 4554B would still be applicable.
As
they would still stand as the defense, if you will, the outline of proof, if you will, that this price is not
excessive. Okay, that helps me understand.
With respect to the issue of whether this statute is at odds with the Patent Act, one must consider the true nature of the patent right, as this court has recognized on a number of occasions. What the patent grant gives a patentee is the right to exclude. The patentee's right to make, sell, or use the patented entity is not part of the grant. That is the natural right that the patentee has regardless of the grant of the patent. And Judge Rich has observed in his 1942 treatise on the nature of the patent right, the natural right to make, use, or sell is subject to the general law. It's subject to the application of the state's power, police power, to protect its citizenry, certainly from outrageous and unconscionable trade conduct. And that is what has been undertaken here by the District of Columbia.
Would that same logic really be applicable to any patented product? If televisions were being sold in the District of Columbia at a higher price than they were sold in China or somewhere else, would it be an excessive price aspect of it? Or is it the patent?
I think the District of Columbia, as could any jurisdiction, be concerned with the unconscionable pricing of items other than prescription drugs. Yes, sir.
Any patented product?
Any patented product, yes, sir.
What about unpatented product?
Yes, that as well.
So you're saying that the District of Columbia could say that all products which are excessively priced within the District of Columbia based upon a particular base price, whether it's a foreign price or another state price, could be subject to challenge by the District of Columbia?
I am saying that the District of Columbia, as does other states, has the police power to regulate the excessive prices.
Let me see if I understand where the distinction between the power to sell and the power to exclude,
yes,
goes logically. Would you go so far as to say that there would be no preemption for example, of a statute. This is hypothetical, obviously.
Yes.
But of a statute which says to all manufacturers of patented drugs that you may charge your marginal cost. That is to say, the cost of producing, not the cost of research or anything else, not the capital expense, none of that, but just your marginal cost of production and distribution, but no more. Which is to say that you will have, we will simply say that you are going to be in the business of providing a public service, in effect, for free. But you will have the exclusive right to provide that public service for free.
Your Honor,
would that be a... I mean, setting aside any due process or substantive due process,
yes,
or anything else,
yes,
would that be preempted by the patent laws? Is it? Would that be inconsistent with the purpose of the patent?
I would say it would be preempted by the patent law because
why,
but the expectation that this right to exclude will give the patentee the opportunity to pursue research and development.
Well, in other words, what you mean is to make a profit that would be greater than the profit that patentee would make in the absence of an exclusive
profit. In the presence of competition.
To use a nasty word, monopoly profits.
Monopoly profits.
Right.
Yes.
But once you say that, it seems to me, then we're just sort of haggling over the price. We've already established that preemption has a role to play in the question of whether... there can be price limitations, aren't we?
Well, Your Honor, to utilize Your Honor's hypothetical, if you have a law that explicitly excludes the opportunity to pursue research and development...
Well, I'm not saying you can't do it. I'm just saying you're not.
Well,
if you're going to find the money, you better get it from a foundation. In other words, you're just limiting the price. That's the only thing you do.
If you have a law that excludes pursuing research and development from the profits that can be gleaned from your monopolization of the market, I think there is a problem there, because the underlying premise of giving the monopoly is that it would encourage research and development.
But there are other premises too underlying the patent laws that are very closely allied with the premise of encouraging research and development, one of which, again, to use a dirty word, is greed. I mean,
yes,
the idea of the patent law is predicated in part on the idea that inventors, animated by eagerness to do very well in the market, will put in extra effort. Now,
that is true.
Drawing a line between research and development, which sounds good, and greed, which sounds not so good, is a line that I don't see the patent law drawing. I mean,
I agree, the patent law doesn't draw it, but more importantly, in the context of this case, Congress has not excluded the right of the states to exercise their police power to draw that line.
Well, that's the question. I mean, that's what we have to decide.
I think that is...
They haven't done it explicitly, that's for sure.
They have not explicitly, nor, I would submit, with regards to the stated objectives of the Patent Act, or how those objectives are being pursued by the provisions of the Act, that it indicates an intent on the part of Congress to step into that area of price control.
Although Congress, Mr. Earle, has recognized, I'm sure you're familiar with the Hatch-Waxman Act, legislative history. In that act, Congress stated the patents enable innovators to obtain greater profits than could have been obtained if direct competition existed. These profits act as an incentive for innovation activities. Don't you think that there's a recognition of the particular profits that drug manufacturers need to obtain in order to innovate?
I would accept that as that recognition, Your Honor, but by the same token, that does not suggest that Congress has meant to forestall the states from undertaking their responsibility to their citizens of restraining the pricing of patent prescription drugs. Where those drugs cross the line between undertaking or encouraging innovation and the furthering of needed research.
But if this, if the Congress sets up a structure which allows for generic drug manufacturers to compete within that particular structure, isn't that really an intent by Congress to take over that particular aspect and saying to everyone else that we will allow the competition to take place through generics and we will allow the patented drug companies to maintain their prices or their profits based to without any control on prices? Is that an inference that can be taken from that?
Your Honor, I submit that does not support that inference. What that supports is certainly the intent of Congress to ensure that the patentee has the full opportunity to utilize and exploit the market exclusivity that it has for a realistic period that's not undermined by the period of regulatory review that the Hatch-Waxman Act was in part intended to ameliorate. But that does not speak to one way or the other that this is the only means by which Congress views the ultimate rendering of lower prices to consumers to be pursued.
This raises a related question, and that is the statute, the ordinance. What do you call that? An ordinance or a statute?
The statute.
Statute.
Yes.
The statute appears to contemplate case-by-case litigation.
Yes.
And one of the questions that I'm puzzling about is if you do case-by-case litigation, would the problem of interference with R&D profits with whatever you concede that the Patent Act Congress had the notion of allowing a inventor or patent holder to make something more than just the cost of production,
allowing him the opportunity,
not
the guarantee.
Allowing him, and I want to come back to that. We'll talk about monopoly a little later, but for the moment, on a case-by-case basis, is it your notion that does the statute contemplate that issue would be litigated in the context of any particular drug product or any particular prescription that was thought to be excessively priced? Is that the notion that issue? But let me put the question a little differently. Is the issue before us on this pre-enforcement preemption case substantively different from what it would be if it came before us on a question of whether a particular prescription for Nexium or Prilosec or whatever was overpriced? Would these issues be the same in your thinking?
I think they would be different because at this facial challenge stage, what we are undertaking is, or what the plaintiffs rather have to establish, is that there's no conceivable interpretation of this statute that would not interfere with the objectives of the Patent Act. And once again, if you accept the premise that the grant of the patent is the power to exclude, not the power to sell, use, or make, then you have to accept, it seems to me, that although the patent statute coupled with the Hatch-Waxman Act certainly reflects Congress's concern for giving full opportunity to a patentee to pursue the prospect of gaining profits that would encourage research and development, that still does not give the right of the unfettered right of the exercise of price and discretion. That would free, under any circumstances, a patentee from regulation by the state.
But that latter question would be the same whether it came up in pre-enforcement or in individual litigation.
Yes, it would be if a given plaintiff made a claim that obviously was proven to be an unreasonable obstacle to a given manufacturer's pursuit of research and development. Not only would that be, I would submit, a valid defense under the statute's own terms, but it would also give a basis for a preemption argument as well.
The drug manufacturers have an ability to sell.
I'm sorry?
They have an ability to sell within the parameters of their patent.
Yes, sir.
What if they decided that because of the restrictions imposed on prices, we'll just withdraw from the market? We won't sell.
Yeah, I don't see that as being a basis for preempting the statute. That would be a decision that the patentee is free to make, but not compelled to make, certainly. Under
any
conceivable interpretation of this statute. And that, actually, Your Honor's question touches upon the substance of the appellee's foreign commerce claim, wherein they argue that because our statute makes reference to the pricing in the high-income countries, that by itself is a violation of the Foreign Commerce Clause. And as we pointed out in our reply, there is a distinction between a statute which has the effect of regulating commerce in another jurisdiction and one that has an effect on those commercial decisions. And to be sure, this statute may have an effect on the commercial decisions that the manufacturers make, the multinational manufacturers, but that is certainly not the same as regulating their conduct. Their conduct is regulated by those foreign countries, not by the statute.
The record suggests that the District of Columbia has very high drug prices.
Yes, sir.
Is there any explanation for why they're higher in the District of Columbia than anywhere else? Or
you know,
anywhere else, but higher.
I am not in a position to illuminate the oral.
Okay.
I think we've gone quite a bit over, I think it's time usefully spent. Why don't we restore your full rebuttal time, and we'll add, Ms. Thomas will add 18 minutes to Mr. Ogden, 20 minutes to Mr. Ogden's time to take care of the additional rebuttal time as well, in case, 15 plus 20, right.
Thank you.
Mr. Ogden, I understand the financial impact that all of this may have on your clients, but in the future I would hope that your clients could come up with a little money to get a better binder. My pages have fallen out on me, and it makes it very hard to follow your argument.
I apologize, Your Honor. I certainly will try to address that in the future.
Thank you.
But I do think it may establish our injury in the case.
Your standing is obviously absolutely right here.
Cause a limitation on prices.
Well, I want to first address the standing arguments that the District of Columbia has raised here, and then turn to the preemption issues and the foreign commerce issues, if I may. Critically, the standard that applies here needs to be the standard applied by the Supreme Court of the United States, and if we satisfy the precedents of the Supreme Court, then we clearly have standing. And therefore, I think, as Mr. Earle concedes, the appropriate place to look here is to the Supreme Court precedents. I do think we satisfy the Parker test, but I think that Parker itself reflects that goes beyond what's necessary in the Supreme Court's standards.
You agree we are not in any sense bound by the D.C. Circuit's problem with standing, but we're free to make our own standing decision?
Absolutely agree. The microchip technology case stands for that proposition in 2004 decision of this court, and it makes manifest sense that the rule of convenience that dictates deference to the regional circuit would not apply when this court concluded that the regional circuit was out of step with its own authorities. And so it is the Supreme Court standard that applies, and that is under the test set forth in the Farm Workers case, set forth in the Pinnell case. They're standing to bring a pre-enforcement challenge where a challenger faces, quote, a realistic danger of sustaining a direct injury as a result of the statute's operation or enforcement. In fact, D.C. in its brief conceded this at page 20, that was the correct test. And the Supreme Court has gone further to make clear that a well-founded fear, which is the language of Virginia Re American Booksellers, a well-founded fear that the law would be enforced, or a realistic danger, in the words of Farm Workers' case, is merely one that is not imaginary or wholly speculative or unadorned speculation. That's from Babbitt again and Pinnell. Here we easily meet that standard. I think Mr. Earle conceded in his argument in response to the questioning from the bench that the D.C. Council clearly thought that our members were affected by and the prices charged by our members with drugs that were resold here in the district were potentially violative of the statute, and indeed are violative of the statute.
Which is the question that we should be asking here? Is it the question of whether you will be likely to be subject to the act, as in targets of actions, or is it whether you will be ultimately found to have been violative of the act? What's the right standard to look at with respect to the standing issue?
It's sufficient to establish standing that there is a realistic threat of prosecution or enforcement, that is, of a lawsuit. And in fact, in the Teva Pharmaceuticals decision just last week, this court looked specifically at the threat of protracted litigation as a sufficient basis to support standing, even if you're not ultimately in violation. And this court frequently entertains standing in the declaratory judgment context, in which the position of the plaintiff is that it's not in violation, but that it stands a substantial risk of being sued. And it is that risk that establishes that is a realistic danger. And it's a realistic danger either that you may be subjected to enforcement efforts, or that to avoid that, a reasonable fear of that you would conform your conduct to the statutory command and therefore forfeit the federal rights that you assert. That's the realistic danger in MedImmune. The court talks about that precise thing, that if there's a sufficient risk of enforcement or of coerced compliance, that suffices. And here, the statute itself declares in its findings that current market prices are excessive. And it says it's incumbent on the government of the District of Columbia to take action to restrain it. And it singles out manufacturers as the sole entities, and their licensees as the sole entities against whom the statute can be enforced. It exempts retailers. And in the legislative history, it also empowers literally anyone to sue, anyone representing the public interest as a private attorney general can enforce the law, whether they're directly or indirectly injured. And in the legislative history, the sponsor, as was noted, singled out two members of Pharma, who were members of both Pharma and Bio, and specific patented drugs sold by those members, and said not only that they would potentially be the subject of suit, but said that their specific patented pharmaceuticals exceeded by more than 30% the prices for those pharmaceuticals charged in one case Germany, in another case Australia, which are the benchmark countries. So in the legislative history, two of our members are singled out as satisfying the presumption, and the sponsor said they'd have an opportunity to explain those differences in litigation.
With respect to the explanation, I don't know if that's actually the safe harbor, but the 4554B, I guess, is the provision. Does that contemplate an explanation that would go to the specific costs of development of a particular drug as you read that, or does it allow the defendant to make an argument that the defendant is engaged in the production of numerous drugs, most of which are never make it successfully to market? And therefore,
I understand your question, and I think this it's actually unambiguous in limiting the justification, the cost justification, to the particular drug.
I mean, you could always say, well, the cost of production includes all the drugs that we didn't bring to market, and we're allocating all those costs to this drug, which we did. But your take on it is that that would be at least a stretch?
I think the literal reading of the statute would tend to preclude it, although, you know, one doesn't know. I think it points up, jumping to the merits, one of the fundamental problems with this statute, which is that it sets up the idea of a case-by-case litigation under the shadow of treble damages, in which a D.C. judge or a D.C. jury would go about attempting to apply the factors that Congress has looked at repeatedly over many years in setting up the scheme of patent protection and indeed limitations on patents that the Congress has put in place. But perhaps in ways that are entirely different, or at least somewhat different, than the way Congress itself has thought about it, so that it may be that the costs of developing other drugs, which may involve hundreds of millions of dollars or more in drugs that never produce a profit, can't be considered. And it highlights both the perils of allowing a litigation system to pass drug by drug on whether a price or an amount of compensation is appropriate. And it also, I think, shows the way in which the D.C. law upsets the balance or threatens the balance that Congress established.
Although, I suppose if Congress did it, there'd be absolutely, well, maybe not absolutely, I suppose one could think of arguments, but obviously the preemption issue would be gone. But if Congress wrote exactly that statute, I can't think of how you would frame an argument that that's invalid.
Well, there wouldn't be a preemption argument. I think that's correct, Your Honor. And I think the fact that Congress, despite repeatedly over many, many years in the pharmaceutical context, has considered the issue of supporting innovation in these critically important products, the issue of the availability of these products to the widest number of people, has used the generic mechanism in Hatch-Waxman expediting the entry of...
What if the District of Columbia adopted a statute that taxed patented drugs on a proportional basis and said the tax will normally be 100% of the sale price, but it can go up to as much as 300% unless the manufacturer can show, and then it puts out those factors that it already has in the statute. What about that?
I think that statute would be, if I understand the hypothetical, Your Honor, would be preempted for the same reasons that this one is.
What about the Weber case, Weber versus Virginia?
Well, Chief Justice Marshall in the McCulloch v. Maryland case himself said that a tax targeted at patented goods, limited to patented goods, would be a violation of the Supremacy Clause. And that's because, and it, particularly where it's targeted to the higher prices of patented goods, it's a special burden that would reduce in a targeted way the benefit Congress intended to make possible. A general tax obviously doesn't raise those kinds of issues. A tax that applies generally to all products, but a special targeted tax that's targeted just to patented products would be problematic, especially if it's further targeted to pharmaceuticals, where Congress has enacted a scheme in very fine and precise ways to try to make these incentives target special areas so that, for example, pediatric testing merits a 6-month extension of the exclusivity period. If D.C. or any other state can come in and issue targeted taxes at those very drugs, it would take away entirely, countermand the incentive.
But all of those provisions in the patent law are always directed, and I think this is true of everything in Hatch-Waxman, at playing with the exclusivity factor.
Right.
And as Mr. Earle points out, that's the core concern in patent law. Now, there may be an assumption that along with exclusivity goes the opportunity, assuming the conditions are right, to make large profits. But the question that makes this case hard, it seems to me, is a question of conflict preemption, is whether Congress has simply said, we aren't going to attend to that question of whether you will actually be able to make large profits or not. We'll just tend to the question of exclusivity, and the rest of it will be up to all the other considerations, including the market, including state regulation, including customer preferences, including the availability of competing products that are not within patent. You're on your own after you have the exclusivity, but the exclusivity is the right that the patent law gives you. Now, where do we find the connection between the exclusivity and the opportunity to make substantial profits as something that's been blessed by Congress?
The inquiry under implied preemption doctrine, under the obstacle preemption doctrine, is whether the state provision poses an obstacle to the accomplishment and execution of the full purposes and objectives.
Right.
But the question is, where is it in the Patent Act that says one of its purposes is to let you make big profits?
Well, what is the premise, and this court has repeatedly said that the fundamental purpose of the patent grant is the encouragement of investment-backed risk. And that is also, as I think Judge Garrison pointed out, the purpose of much of the pharmaceutical exclusivity law. This court said in the Pfizer case that the Hatch-Waxman, for example, the incentive to develop and market products that require lengthy pre-marketing approval is intended to be preserved in those laws. So it is the encouragement, the incentivizing of investment-backed risk, which is the purpose. The exclusivity right is a particular means, and it's the central means, by which that purpose is meant to be accomplished. But the measurement of whether a law, a state law, presents an obstacle to the accomplishment of those purposes has to look to how that exclusivity right is intended to create the encouragement of investment-backed risk. And this court has addressed that question, too, as have a number of others. This court has, in the King Instruments case, explained that following. The Patent Act creates an incentive for innovation. The economic rewards during the period of exclusivity are the carrot. That is, it's the economic rewards during the period of exclusivity that are the incentive. The exclusivity itself is the means. And then the court went on to say, upon grant of the patent, the only limitation on the size of the carrot should be the dictates of the marketplace. Now, it is so the key issue is, in the marketplace, subject to general background regulation, of course.
Yeah, I mean, that's a little bit of an overstatement.
But Mr. Ogden,
The statement that the court, I mean, this is our statement, so I can criticize it, but that's a bit of an overstatement, because there are all sorts of things that can be out there created by the state that will restrict the ability to make a profit, including that the District of Columbia could increase the sales tax across the board by 5%, and then I suppose you could raise your prices, but that would certainly have at least some effect on your ability to make a profit.
But those kinds of general background regulations, a general non-discriminatory tax, a general health and safety regulation that isn't targeted to patents or doesn't zero in on the profits to be made from patented goods is part of the general environment in which the marketplace is expected to operate. You've produced a patented good. How useful is it? How valuable is it? The price you can charge depends during the period of exclusivity on the effectiveness of non-infringing substitutes. That will keep the price at the level the market establishes. That's the premise of the patent laws during exclusivity. There's a patent premium that's created by that exclusivity, which is the difference between that state of affairs and the state of affairs when the patent is terminated, and competition from generics in the pharmaceutical area comes in, removes the patent premium. That patent premium, that delta between what a patented good can earn and what the good off patent can earn, that is the incentive, that is the carrot, that is the engine of patent law and pharmaceutical
exclusivity. But isn't the Hatch-Waxman Act enacted by Congress really an attempt by Congress to provide for an expedient method of getting generic drugs to market for competitive purposes, at least trying to create some competition for some of the patented drugs?
Yes.
Even during the term of the patent, if they can challenge the patent under the certification. Why wouldn't the D.C. statute then be considered complementary to that intent of Congress to maintain competition and to essentially provide drugs at a reasonable price to consumers?
The Hatch-Waxman Act does a number of things, but it addresses the patent premium and the incentive side, the carrot side, in a very precise way, and it addresses the price control side in the sense of mechanisms to bring the price down. And the thing that's central to it all is that the mechanism of Congress is relying on market mechanisms. Hatch-Waxman extends the patent period during the period of FDA approval consideration of the new drug up to a 5-year period. That is specifically because of the concern that Congress had that the long delays in obtaining approval would eat into the financial incentive. The D.C. law is not complementary because it takes away the very incentive, potentially, to the extent that it operates at all, to the extent that it finds that the patent premium is too high. It takes away the very incentive the Hatch-Waxman Act intended to extend. Hatch-Waxman also is instructive, Your Honor, and I think the point's quite important, as to the way Congress expects the world of patents and the world of pharmaceuticals to operate, which is we need to have this incentive of the full patent premium, the full incentive to not just to incentivize your development of new products in terms of paying for it, but in terms of giving a profit incentive to cause people to make these extraordinary, highly risky investments. We want to have that big incentive. We're going to do it by having a period of exclusivity during which you can get the full patent premium. But we're also, in the pharmaceutical area, we're going to bring in generics and allow them to enter the market very fast so that when that period ends, the patent premium is gone. For DC to attack the patent premium is for DC to attack the entire engine of innovation that Congress has established. And that's the central point in this case.
How do you, even though Congress did not speak to the issue of regulation of prices at the Hatch-Waxman, it was an inferential type of a statement?
Well, it's the classic circumstance, I think, where Congress's decision over long periods of time not to engage in certain forms of regulation, coupled with the obvious statements of what their purposes are and the obvious understanding of how this mechanism is supposed to work, makes clear that Congress doesn't want. It has decided that leaving that unregulated is the best approach. And in Hatch-Waxman, you know, Congressman Waxman did address, when he explained how all of this works, he addressed it in a way very much in line with the way this court has explained the purpose.
If you were sitting on the D.C. Council and you were looking at what seems to be conceded high, if not extremely high, prices for pharmaceuticals in your jurisdiction, and you were looking at a substantial population of people who are uninsured in the healthcare field and needed drugs, how would you go about making it possible for those drugs to be more accessible to your citizenry?
Well, there are any number of different mechanisms that exist. Obviously, there are the federal healthcare programs. The pharmaceutical companies themselves have.
You're in the D.C. You're on the D.C. Council, you're not the president of the United States in my hypothetical. So the federal government isn't going to help you. Now what?
Well, Your Honor, I think there may be a number of things with respect to state programs and city funding programs.
Would you object to a tax?
I think a targeted tax at patented pharmaceuticals is simply not appropriate. It is a specific burden, a substantial one on a federal right. McCulloch v. Maryland itself stands for the proposition you can't do that.
How about
a tax would be very problematic.
What would you suggest then?
Well,
Counselor?
I guess what I've suggested is that I think there are the possibility of funding programs, obviously. But what D.C. can't do is to target patented goods and to target the patent premium pharmaceuticals, which Congress cares about. Congress has developed a scheme to create the finest pharmaceuticals, the finest drugs in the world, and that scheme depends upon the patent premium. That's the genius or the heart of the United States program for encouraging innovation, is permitting these during the limited period of exclusivity, a targeted limited period, to allow that patent premium to be earned, to let the states come in and say, no, that's too much in this case, or it's way too much in that case, we're going to have treble damages. Because another critical element here is the deterrence factor, which I think is quite important in terms of recognizing the interference with Congress's objectives. When you attach treble damages to sales that can occur anywhere in the United States, and you attach treble damages potentially to all the dealings that a company has that end up in the District of Columbia, you create a tremendous interim effect that in and of itself is going to deter companies from charging what the market will bear, which again is the underlying assumption of what Congress is going about here.
I think a moment ago when you were talking about the role of state health and safety regulation, those kinds of across-the-board, non-targeted regulations, you mentioned in your list of factors that would render those benign in our context, that it wasn't directed at limitations on price, although it might have the effect of limiting the profits that companies could make. What about an across-the-board, and this is a targeted statute, clearly, but what about an across-the-board provision that simply says the District of Columbia has a policy against excess prices, whether it's for television sets, drugs, or bicycles, or anything else, and whether it's patented or not. Now, you know, the impact might be, and it's calculated according to some number, whether it's correlates to foreign countries or not, but it definitely puts a ceiling of some sort on the profits that anybody can make on sales in the District of Columbia. If it's not targeted at patents, do you think it's preempted because it has an impact on people who have patents?
No. I mean, I don't think for that reason alone, I don't think it's preempted. I think that laws of general applicability that truly operate in a neutral fashion and
are... Well, when you say operate in a neutral fashion, now let me hasten to say that we'll assume that the bulk of the actions brought under such a statute will be against people who have monopolies, and patents will be the most common reason to have monopolies. So we'll stipulate that 70% of the actions that end up getting brought turn out to be against people with patents, and a lot of those will be against pharmaceutical companies.
Well, you know, obviously,
but you think it's still okay? It's not preempted by the patent law.
I think it lacks the two critical elements here that make this clearly a statute that has to be preempted. The two critical elements being the focus on the pharmaceutical area, which is critically focused on by Congress over many years and many statutes, titrating these benefits and the limits in a very precise way based on the idea of a patent premium, and the singling out of patented goods. Either of those things in a statute that imposes substantial burdens that's targeted at the patent premium independently would be a sufficient basis. If you take both of those away, I think you end up with a much more nuanced inquiry. It would depend on how the statute actually operated. You'd have to look at what the federal statutes were that were being suggested as being threatened. The details become very important in that situation.
Let's step back one step from Judge Bryson's hypothetical. Let's assume the regulation or the statute applied only to all patented goods. Would that be a problem?
The same statute? I think it would be a, yes, I think it would definitely.
A general statute that
yes, I think
said
it would
all patented goods must be sold at a not cannot be sold at an excessive price.
Yes, I think that would be clearly a problem. I think it would be.
You don't have the Hatch-Waxman.
One of the two pillars here. You don't have Hatch-Waxman, and you don't have the special issues of pharmaceutical regulation, which have occupied a tremendous amount of Congress's attention over the years. So you've got one of the two bases, but I think either of them is sufficient. If you target patented goods only for to take away the patent premium, that's a frontal assault on Congress's patent policy. And Congress could have its own, could have instituted a scheme where if you have a patent, you have to justify your price, and it has to be titrated. We have to do case-by-case decision whether you're recovering too much or not recovering enough. That's not what Congress did.
So your answer to Judge Bryson's hypothetical of a neutrally stated cap, I take it, is, well, we'd have trouble with a pre-enforcement suit, but boy, we could come at you if you came at us individually.
Well, I don't think I would probably phrase my answer that way. What I was struggling to express was that we rely on these two highly problematic aspects of this law, the singling out of patents, the singling out of pharmaceuticals, the targeting of the patent premium in the exclusivity premium in that context. If you take both of those away, the issue becomes more nuanced. You have to look at the legislative history, the actual impact, and the way federal policies are affected. In their
because case. Ultimately, obviously, I mean, as you know, I mean, ultimately you back in not only to the Patterson case with the health and safety regulations, but ultimately Nebbia against New York, and you know, you wouldn't think that you would have a constitutional regime that would say that price limitation is permissible as long as the only goods that are regulated are not protected by patent. That would be peculiar, I think.
I think that probably would be peculiar, and I think again, if the state is legislating across the board, it can have health and safety regulations, it can have taxes,
or even price controls. I mean, Nebbia was a price control case. They said you can sell milk up to this price and no more.
Yeah, in your hypothetical, which doesn't focus either on pharmaceuticals or patents, poses that case. And the only footnote I want to put on it is I need to see the statute and you need to see how it worked before you said whether it interfered with any congressional objectives or not. But I think those are the two key elements that we rely on.
I think we have your case.
I'd like to turn briefly, unless there are other questions on the preemption of standing issues, to the question of the foreign commerce clause. This case is really on all fours in this respect with the Healy against the Beer Institute case, which, in the context of the interstate commerce clause, established the invalidity of a regime in which the prices in one state were not permitted to exceed the prices in another. And the reasoning of the Supreme Court in the Healy case as to why a state cannot do that fully applies here and invalidates each and every application of the tying provision of this statute. What Healy said is, by tying maximum future prices in one state to the lowest prices in other states, such laws control pricing decisions in those other states by requiring that those decisions reflect not only local market conditions, but also market conditions in the regulated state, market conditions that would be irrelevant absent the binding force of the statute. Mr. Earle conceded, as he has to, because the record is clear and the operation of the statute is obvious, that pricing decisions in foreign countries necessarily would be affected by the District of Columbia's statute. And all the more so, of course, if other states were to enact a similar provision. You would have to consider the potential for treble damages in the United States, the potential for being in violation of law in the United States, the potential for injunctions in the United States, when you decided whether to do business in Australia or Germany or Canada. You'd have to consider the impact on your pricing in the United States when those command more command-driven governments required prices be at marginal cost or very close to it. As the Valiant Pharmaceutical Company says in their affidavit, if the DC law applies, they're not going to even sell their drug in Australia or in Canada because they don't want to have that consequence. Well, that extraterritorial regulation, that effective regulation in the sense of Healy of those foreign transactions is violative of the Foreign Commerce Clause, which is at least as restrictive of extraterritorial regulation as the Interstate Commerce Clause under Japan law. And the district judge declined to address this issue because he concluded, it was superfluous as an operational matter since he invalidated the statute as a whole. But beyond that, he didn't reach it because he said that it was an improper facial challenge because there might be applications of the statute in which the particular provision was not invoked. But it is a proper facial challenge because it is a challenge to that provision, which is improper in all of its applications. Anytime you attach a significant legal consequence to the application of that provision, it induces this improper regulatory effect. It's therefore necessarily invalid under the Foreign Commerce Clause and needs to be stricken. We believe that as a result, it leaves the statute that as a whole has to be invalidated, that provision cannot be severed because that provision, prima facie case, is the only aspect of this statute that provides any guidance whatsoever about what is or isn't an excessive price. And if you end up with a statute that has not even that amount of guidance, it's first of all probably invalid for a number of other constitutional reasons given its lack of determinacy. But it is not plausible that the council would have enacted a law with no standards at all.
They don't have the usual, if any one part is severed, the rest is still good provision, do they?
There's not a clause of that kind in the statute itself.
Separability clause, yeah.
Okay.
Could you comment just for 10 seconds on the question that Judge Gayarsa raised at the outset, which is why are you here? I take it when you filed your complaint in the District of Columbia District Court, you did not see it as a patent case.
Well, the case turns, we believe, when District of Columbia suggested to us that their appeal should be in this court rather than in the D.C. Circuit, we took a look at this and concluded that their position was a reasonable one in that under the second aspect of the Christensen decision, Section 1338 applies where the plaintiff's right to relief necessarily depends on resolution of a substantial question of federal patent law, in that patent law is a necessary element of one of the well-pleaded claims. And we do think that our preemption argument turns to a significant degree on questions of patent law, that is, the degree to which the D.C. law obstructs the purposes and objectives and their full achievement. We believe it reasonable to view that as a substantial part of federal patent law for purposes of this court's jurisdiction, which is why we didn't object.
Okay. Very well. Thank you, Mr. Ogden. Mr. Pearl, I think we reserve 5 minutes for you.
Your Honor, let me emphasize, first of all, with respect to the preemption issue, that notwithstanding the patent premium that counsel had made reference to, there is no authority for proposition that the patentee's commercial conduct is completely free of regulation. And not even in the pricing arena. This court has recognized in application of the patent misuse doctrine that minimum price fixing agreements between patentees and their licensees is a per se a violation of the Antitrust Act. That pertains to the exercise of a patentee's pricing discretion.
But that doesn't raise supremacy clause problems since the regulator is part of the supremacy.
That is true, Your Honor, but it does reflect that the grant of the patent and the operation of the Patent Act does not envision the commercial conduct of the patentee to be free of regulation. Even granting the idea that the grant of the patent is intended to motivate the patentee by its innate desire for profit to undertake research and development that ultimately will benefit the community. Notwithstanding that emphasis on the prospect of profit, it is not unlimited. The marketplace that this court makes reference to in King Instruments is a marketplace that innately includes the prospect of regulation, reasonable regulation by the states of commercial conduct of patentees. A great deal of emphasis is placed in the appellee's argument on the fact that this statute singles out the patentees for regulation. First of all, that is not in and of itself inappropriate, as Allen versus Riley teaches us. And I would submit that in this case, there is a justification similar to that was present in Allen. The special evil here is the unusual ability to pursue unconscionable pricing needed prescription drugs. It is reasonable for the council to have concluded that it was not necessary to undertake their police powers with respect to non-patented drugs because the marketplace itself, the competition that's present in the marketplace as to those entities, would act as a natural restraint. Nonetheless, it was appropriate and reasonable to undertake an exercise of the council's police powers with respect to patented prescription drugs because of their market monopoly granted by the patent. So that is that rationale for striking down this statute, I submit, is not well founded. In the context of the exercise of the council's police powers. With respect to the argument on the application of the Foreign Commerce Clause to this statute, as I indicated in my earlier remarks, there is a distinction to be drawn between the statute that was at issue in Healy that clearly had the effect of regulating, of forcing the vendors in other states and the non-regulating states to alter their prices or maintain their prices in response to the requirements of the regulating state. And the circumstance here where there might be a consideration being given by the patentee to the presence of this statute, but that does not compel any